Hello, this is Barbara Peters. I'm sitting on a patio here at the Hotel Valley Ho with Jacqueline Winspear, and I realized today that we've been together since the year 2006, and this is her 17th book we're going to go and discuss this evening. Good Lord, Jackie.
It's actually 2003, Barbara.
Was it 2003? You're right, that makes 16 years.
Exactly, exactly. So, a long time. We go back a long way.
It was. And I remember when you published Maisie Dobbs, and somehow or other, I got you to agree to come, and you stayed in our house, right?
I stayed with you, and if you remember, my gosh, it was only this, I think it was only either the first or the second event I'd ever done, so I was ever so nervous. And I was flying out of Santa Barbara into Phoenix. And do you remember this? Not only was the flight delayed, but when we got into Phoenix, they couldn't open the door.
I do remember
And I
that.
Remember just thinking, if someone would give me a sledgehammer, I will get us all off this plane, because I just wanted to get off the plane. I was so anxious. And I think you were winging it a bit when I got to the store and I just flew in and we took it from there.
We did. I remember you sitting on the couch with our then dog, whose name was Casey, afterward, and realized we were bonding over dogs.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
In fact, you gave me a wonderful railway, actually gave to my husband, a wonderful railway poster with a wire-haired fox terrier standing in the door of the baggage car.
Yes.
As a commemorative.
That's right. It was a very, it was a famous poster from, I think, the 1930s. They did several with fox terriers, and that one was sort of, you know, you can take the train anywhere. Anyone can take the train anywhere, and it's a fox terrier.
I still have it framed and mounted in our kitchen as a memorial. Well, let's see. This is your 17th book. Was it one, not Maisie Dobbs, or two?
There's two, because there was The Care and Management of Lies,
right,
which was a standalone and not a mystery. And then there's the new book, What Would Maisie Do?, which is nonfiction. It's a collection of readers' favorite passages from the books and me talking about what inspired those passages.
Indeed so. The very book we're probably going to run out of this evening. Right. So, Maisie Dobbs, all the way. I was looking at my cover of, I mean, the dust jacket of your book earlier this afternoon, because I still have my beautiful autographed copy. And there's her face is portrayed on the cover of the book, which is somewhat unusual, because oftentimes publishers want the art, you know, to be, to let the reader fill in what the person looks like. And so, do you remember why it had that particular cover? It's on my mind because I just saw it.
I remember they sent me two possible covers, and both had images of women from that era, from the 1920s, 30s, and asked me which one I preferred. And funnily enough, in the first instance, it wasn't the one that ended up on the cover. I thought the other one was a bit more mysterious, which, funnily enough, later went on to the cover of a Spanish edition of the book. But I think what was wonderful about that image is that it really set the scene for who Maisie Dobbs is, because you could just see so much about her in the eyes of this image, which is actually a real person. It was someone got it from, I think, Getty Images or somewhere like that. There was a certain haunted nature in the eyes, and you know, people always said about Maisie Dobbs that you know, when she looked at you, you felt as though she was looking right through you. And when I looked at that photograph, I think that's exactly what I saw. Here's the interesting thing about that photograph, though. When they sent it to me and said this is the one we're actually going with, in the image she was the woman had a fur collar. And I am so anti using fur for, you know, decorative, fashionable purposes. And I said, I think it's okay, but would you please try and lose the collar? And someone said, oh yeah, piece of cake, and obviously got in there with the, you know, Photoshop and gave her an ordinary collar.
Well, there's something I didn't know. It is a very personal cover with a lot of personality. I asked you that in part because your covers are quite stylized now. You know,
they
there's
are.
A definite look to them, which is different. And I don't remember that we actually see Maisie. Do we see Maisie up close again?
No, we don't.
I didn't think so.
Not up close. Often it's and they've become more refined as time has gone on. As Andrew, who's the artist craftsman who creates the artwork, as he's he's got to know Maisie a lot better. And and in fact, the cover for the latest book, it has a story in itself, because about 5-6 years ago, Andrew said to me, and he not only creates the initial sketches, but the covers are taken from woodcuts that he does, and then he prints it on this very old press he has in his home studio. But he said to me, you know, Jackie, I've always wanted to do a typical Blitz scene with searchlights and fire and all those things from the Blitz. You know, his family come originally from the same part of London as mine came from, so he knew all those stories of the Blitz and so on. And I said, you know, Andrew, you will have a chance to do that, but not for a while. And then it was about just over a year ago, I was asked to get in touch with Andrew to share my ideas in the cover, and I just said, here we go, it's your cover, the Blitz.
So this particular book, The American Agent, actually the American in it harks back two books, right? Was it two? The Journey to Munich?
Journey to Munich, that's when we first meet Mark Scott. Right. But he might not actually be the only American agent.
No, that's true. But we did meet him in an earlier book.
Yes.
But I had an amusing moment yesterday, because when we were sending out our invitation to come to your event this evening, which is Tuesday, March 26th, the actual publication date of The American Agent, I had written, you know, we're moving from the Boer War, B-O-R-E, to the Blitz. And one of my staff wrote back and said, that can't be right. It must be the Boer War. You've made a typo.
No.
And I wrote back and said, no, actually, the Boer War was, you know,
it's what people call
45
it.
Years earlier. I see it as an easy mistake. But in point of fact, it was the Boer War. Why did you call it that?
Well, that's what people called it at the time. After war was declared in September 1939, right up until really Dunkirk, nothing happened. And people thought something was going to happen immediately. They were going to be bombed. And whilst there had been a lot of preparation for possible invasion, bombing and so on, it just, nothing seemed to happen. And so the papers and people just started calling it the Boer War, because it was getting really boring. You know, it was just like the Boer War that was never going to happen. In the American press, it was referred to as the Phony War. And then, of course, Dunkirk happened, and then, you know, the Battle of Britain. And then we were off to the races, so to speak.
Yes, things really heated up.
Very, very quickly.
So what was different about the Blitz in London as compared to, say, just bombing raids in terrible places like other cities? Was there something that distinguished the Blitz?
There was very much something that distinguished Blitzkrieg. This was a bombing technique, if you will, that had actually been tested by Hitler and his Luftwaffe during the Spanish Civil War, when they came to the aid of Franco. And it was also used in Poland, in France, and throughout Europe to really terrify people and to pave the way for invasion. And what it is, there had actually been sort of bombing before the Blitz, and much of that was sort of geared towards the Luftwaffe was bombing military installations of one sort or another. Blitzkrieg was comprised of hundreds of aircraft, and they came in a V formation across the channel with very specific let's say destinations in mind, very specific targets, and it was invariably just hundreds of bombers flanked by fighter aircraft. And they came in, and can you imagine it, the first Blitz was actually happened in the afternoon, and the skies utterly darkened with aircraft. And they weren't just, you know, letting go of heavy bombs, devastating bombs, but they were letting go of thousands of incendiary devices at the same time, which would go everywhere, and of course they would cause more fires. One of the most devastating nights of the Blitz was actually December 29th, 1940, when Göring, who was head of the Luftwaffe, planned it extremely well, because not only was it what they called a bomber's moon, it was a full moon. The bombers came in V formation, hundreds of them, went right up the Thames, dropping their bombs, dropping the incendiary devices, And because of the climate conditions at the time, it created a firestorm. So the fire just increased and increased and increased. And what happened was that the firemen, what they used to do when they started to run out of water from hydrants and so on, is they used to throw their long hoses into the Thames and suck water out of the Thames. But Goering knew that that night the Thames would be at low tide, so all their hoses were choked with mud. So even firefighting became difficult, and it was just a terrible night. And also other towns were hit by Blitzkrieg. You know, we famously know of Coventry, right. Liverpool, Manchester, Southampton, Portsmouth, and so on. And but that was different from indiscriminate bombing that came before and after. It was a terrible thing to behold.
It was a terrible thing to do. I saw a photograph the other day of Dresden at the end of the war.
Yes.
And I thought to myself, you know, what did they expect? If they were willing to visit that on the British, then why were they surprised and somewhat outraged that it turned around and came back? I mean, it makes no sense either way, but the civilian population is so dreadfully affected. It isn't just people in uniform, you know, fighting, but everybody is caught up in, or in Germany too, as it all turned out.
Well, in the first 2 years of the war, there were, I think, something like 60,000 casualties in terms of the civilian population in Britain, and far outweighed any military casualties.
Right. It's really like the flu after World War One. People don't realize, I think, today that more people died from the influenza epidemic than actually died in the war.
It was tremendous. I mean, it just went worldwide. And in fact, it's interesting that in World War One, America lost 125,000 men, which was actually double the number of men lost in Vietnam. And a purist would say, well, a lot of them died of the flu. But, you know, in any war, people die of non-combat injuries. They die of different things. And disease is rampant during a time of
disease,
war.
Disease, bad hygiene, all those things. So Maisie and her friend,
Priscilla.
It is Priscilla, thank you. I was stuttering there for a moment. Are driving ambulances during the Blitz. This is one of the roles that they have taken on in London. That was a really dangerous thing for them to be doing, wasn't it?
It was a terribly dangerous thing. But, you know, everybody had been asked to sign up for some sort of national service. A lot of women joined, for example, the Women's Voluntary Service, which truly came into its own during the years of the war. Others actually did military service and so on. There was any sort of voluntary service that you could do, you were called upon to put your best foot forward. So Maisie and Priscilla have volunteered for ambulance service, and they're a wee bit older than some of the girls there who had volunteered, but obviously they had experience. They had both been in a previous war. Priscilla had been with the First Aid Nursing Yeomanry and had driven an ambulance in World War One, and as we know, Maisie had been a nurse in that war. So yes, it was a terrible, terrible time.
It was awful for them to revisit it, although in the first war they were driving in France, and now in this war they're driving in London. I don't know which would have been more horrific, really.
I think driving through fire must have been an horrific thing to experience. But then you had to think of all the people you could help on the other end, I suppose. But when I've watched footage of the fires, I think that's what really staggers me, actually, that people drove through that. But then, you know, in a way, so some things come around, because, you know, I live in California and we've had terrible wildfires. And one of my friends, who has a very large horse trailer, went under police escort driving through fire, in and out of fire, to rescue horses and other livestock. You know, and I think driving through fire must be a terrifying thing. You know,
it's amazing how brave people can be in extraordinary circumstances.
When they need to be, yes.
You know, like mothers lifting whole automobiles off children or something. Adrenaline is a remarkably effective part of our physiognomy, of what makes us who we are. So inevitably, because you're writing a murder mystery, Maisie and Priscilla run across body somewhere in the midst of all those splits, and that gets your story going. I wish we could talk about what I think is one of the most interesting parts of the book, but unfortunately it would be a horrible spoiler to do that for people who haven't read it. But I do like the way you've represented the Americans at this time, you know, mm-hmm. not yet committed to the war, before Pearl Harbor, lots of back and forth about whether they should be fighting. Mm-hmm. You know, without Churchill and Roosevelt, I have to wonder how things would have gone. They were two remarkable men who, you know, just powered through all the difficulties to get to where they wanted to go.
I think actually one of the people that you wonder how things might turn out if he hadn't been on the spot, and that's Edward Morrow.
Yes.
Because he didn't actually start in the business when he was working for CBS as a journalist as such. He was basically sort of scheduling the work of other journalists and then came to London. And apparently his early broadcasts, they're just sort of notes on, just rough notes. He didn't even type them out in the early days. But he could see what was happening and that Britain was absolutely holding the line against the Nazi onslaught. And he had the ear of Churchill and he had the ear of Roosevelt, and he played a big part in bringing the reality of war into the around the dining table, I guess, of Americans at home. And Americans absolutely didn't want to be involved in another war, and who could blame them? Most British didn't want to be involved in another war. That's why they kind of in the early 30s were definitely shutting down about any threats and so on, and they absolutely wanted peace because so much had been lost in an earlier war. But you know, there was a very strong isolationist feeling in the United States. But then people, you know, when Morrow did his broadcast, it was sort of 11 o'clock at night, that kind of time. So on the East Coast it was dinner time, you know, let's say, and people around the table listening to this man who had gone out into the streets. He wasn't sounding very proper behind a microphone and necessarily in a studio, but he famously went out into the streets with a microphone and on one occasion held it to the ground and said, "This is the sound of people running for shelter, and this is the sound of bombs, and this is what you can hear." And he made it very alive and immediate, so people suddenly, what was happening 3,000 miles away could have been happening in their own backyard, and people started to realize, you know, if Britain isn't supported in some way, it's going to be happening in our own backyard.
There's a remarkable intimacy about radio.
Yes.
And the other thing is, you know, they were listening to the same person, a trusted source. We didn't have all this, you know, multiple voices, mm-hmm. Unreliable fake news, all the rest of it. Morrow became, I mean, you know, I remember Walter Cronkite, who many of us, you know, listened to and got our news from, Dan mm-hmm. Rather or whatever. That the days of those guys are largely gone. Mm-hmm. And I don't, you know, young people don't realize just how authoritative somebody like Morrow could be, you know, speaking for what was going on and for what he thought mm-hmm. was right. He was an antidote for Lord Hehaw, obviously, the German propaganda mm-hmm. person broadcasting. And who was it, Tokyo Rose on the Japanese
yeah.
front? I don't think, you know, today we can really appreciate just what enormous effect somebody like Morrow and his broadcasts would have in shaking public opinion. I remember him as a child because he went on after the war.
He did,
but
yes.
You're right, he made his bones as a, mm-hmm. you know, as a newsman and an authoritative interpreter, shall we say.
I think he changed the way news was imparted. I think one of the most important things about radio is that how it brought news to ordinary people, because if you go back to the sort of that when radio really started to catch on, 20s and 30s, the news was imparted chiefly by newspapers. And that was a time when, on both sides of the Atlantic, unless you had some money, you left school really young. A lot of people left school semi-literate. You know, the schools were extremely good, but still, if you're leaving at 12 to work in a factory or you're leaving to work on a farm, you're not getting the full breadth of the schooling that you might have otherwise received. And so therefore, when you read a newspaper, it was easy to skim over it, or you missed some of the news, or you just didn't bother. But with the radio, there it was. It brought the news to people who it wouldn't otherwise have been available to. And he made it very immediate, and he changed journalism in a way, because certainly with the BBC at that time, I mean, when radio first started, you had people all men that read the news, and they would actually be required, even though it was not a visual medium, to wear a dinner jacket, a bow tie, and they spoke in a very proper voice, you know? And it was all very measured, and suddenly it all changed.
Very true. And you're also leaving out the fact that radio, listening to the radio, could be a group experience.
Absolutely.
We're back to Marshall McLuhan, and the medium is the message. Reading is a solitary mm-hmm. act. Reading a newspaper is you interacting with the paper. But a group of people, a family, whatever, sitting around mm-hmm. a radio, listening to someone, becomes a collective experience mm-hmm. and has a much different mm-hmm. emotional resonance to it, and all of which you bring alive, I think, very well in The American Agent. And that's probably really all we can say about it without
Absolutely.
Spoiling it. Thank you, Jackie, for your time, and I'm really looking forward to having a good discussion again about it in just an hour or so
Absolutely.
At the bookstore.
Okay, thank
Bye.
You very much.